I am a Lutheran minister, but I am the lucky kind. I'm retired. 1 year ago, when I hit my 67th birthday, I felt it was time to get out. No, not get out, but to start enjoying it, and I am enjoying it immensely. My background is I have been a pastor since 1951, and I've been married 45 years, what was it, week, to Drew, my wife. She was a mere child when I married her. And I began a mission congregation in Southern California. I went back to school, the Southern California School of Theology at Claremont, got my doctor's degree, taught seminary for a year, discovered that that really wasn't my thing. Then I was in campus ministries for 15 years at Portland State University, and then in East Africa, Tanzania, East Africa, in Dar es Salaam, at a nation that became independent. They started their own university, and they had three places, one for a Muslim mullah, one for a Catholic priest, and one for a Protestant, representing all the Protestants of Tanzania. But I was the only full-time person, and I was to organize and set it up in this new university. And initially 300 students, then about adding 300 students each year for 3 years. And then I went to San Francisco State. Many of you know what happened at the end of the 60s during the Vietnamese War and all the student unrest. I had a great time at San Francisco State University. Did a year of sabbatical studies in London, the School of Economics and Political Science there. Came back to San Francisco, and then 1973 went down to Mission Viejo to a five-year-old congregation. And if any of you know Orange County in Southern California is the heart of conservatism in the country, I think. Home of the John Birch Society. And I thought, wow, how did I ever end up here? But I was determined I was going to say the same things in a congregation that I'd said in universities, and generally it went pretty well. There were people that didn't quite agree, but one of the neat things is, I think many people caught the view that you don't always have to agree, but you do have to be authentic in what you do. And we were blessed, had a great congregation there. And then I retired last year, and I'm mountain climbing and traveling and doing all kinds of things now.
Well, you could have been a lot happier because you enjoyed retirement so much, right?
Right.
You could retire when you were 62 and gotten a church pension and Social Security. Five more years of glorious retirement.
Oh, no, no. I was having so much fun, I didn't want to retire then. It just came like a light all of a sudden. Hey, you know, I think I could enjoy stepping out there. No, basically, for me being, I even got paid for doing the job I did. That was what was neat about it. You know, I was doing what I wanted to do. Well, that's who I am. This week, in this course, and incidentally, there is no class tomorrow that I'm conducting. And so if you want to continue in it, it's on Wednesday again. And I don't know what time it is on Wednesday. Anybody? Well, look it up. Wednesday, it's at same time. No, 3:45. 3:45 in the afternoon. And it's a test of intelligence, whether you can get to the place you want to get to. Now, to do it, you pass automatically. What I'm trying to do in this course is talk about a basic problem that I see as far as Christian faith is concerned, the church is concerned, and that is, why is it that so many people are part of congregations and yet there's so few that really either derive great joy from being part of the faith or that it makes a real difference that they call themselves Christian and members of a congregation? In fact, among the people you know, how different are they, the ones who are Christian, how different are they from the ones who are not Christian? Do you see a pretty large distinction? Or is it kind of hard to tell the difference sometimes? My own feeling is if most of us were arrested because we were, you know, if it was unlawful to be Christian, and we were arrested for being a Christian, most of us would never get convicted. There's not enough evidence to convict us. You'd say, oh, I belong to a church. Well, yeah. Well, I don't care if you belong to a church or not. It doesn't make any difference in what you do in life and how you live your lives and so on. Well, my feeling is that there's not that much meaning. That, and some time back, I tried to stress, we're not interested in members in a church. What we're interested in is discipleship in the Christian church. I think that mere membership can become almost like being a member of anything else. You know, you can kind of take some of it and leave some. Discipleship ought to be something different.
A lot of it is with member game, too, with
sure.
Congregation.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Hey, as a pastor, it was nice to have numbers. Well, sometimes I wondered if it was. Well, what is the problem? In my experience, I try to chalk it up to two basic things. One is that people who have a faith get institutionalized. And when they institutionalize their faith, they adopt a set of beliefs. They adopt some patterns of behavior that, you know, that community kind of looks as the way it's supposed to be. And they belong to an institution, the church. But that there's not a lot of power in what they're doing. And that I came to the conclusion, we need a set of beliefs. We need to, have some behavior patterns that characterize us as members of a church. But that discipleship isn't that. Those are not the goals of being a Christian. Those are expressions of being a Christian. But to be a Christian and to be a disciple, as I understand it, is to simply follow Jesus in what he teaches and how he lived out his life and to emulate it. The other problem that I saw was that so many people in the church privatized their religious faith. Now, by that, I don't mean personal. I believe our faith has to be personal. It has to be a relationship to the living God. But it must not be privatized. That is, it shouldn't be removed from the arena of life where life is lived out and become sort of an inner consciousness of some personal, quiet, private relationship between me and Jesus, or me and God. And I think that's what it was for many people as I lived out my life in the life of the church.
Excuse me.
Yes? Larry, I'm sorry about it, but I wanted to get at that. He was a Baptist preacher for 34 years. We were having a good time with him. Now, and I would like to call, of course, not authentic discipleship, although that's a good name. I would like to call it radical discipleship. But that word scares people so much that I started shoving it aside. But to me, to be radical means to go to the root of things. That's what radical means. Doesn't mean going waving your hands and becoming violent or belligerent. It's go to the root of things and then base everything on what that drives you to do. And for discipleship, the root of things is, what did Jesus do? And what did he teach? That's the roots. And discipleship is, that's it. He's the guru. He's the one, the disciple. It's the master we look to. And directions are taken from that one, and not society and the social norms and cultural norms that are around us. By the way, how many of you went to the Bible study this morning that Wes... I went the early one, somebody went the later one. Don't miss it. It's fabulous.
Not at the right time for the elder hostility.
Yeah, I know, that's the conflict. But you can go at 7:30. Hey, I know you get so meetinged out. But he's talking about the Johannine community, and it's really excellent. Just cuts through all kinds of, I think, misunderstandings and lack of understanding about what the gospel is as John presents it. And, as I've observed how I see the difficulties in the church, I believe that the key to discipleship is to not say, now you folks, what are the teachings that you need to believe in? You need to believe in the Trinity, and you need to believe in the Incarnation, and you need to believe in the resurrection. But I taught membership classes for years teaching these things. And people say, yeah. That's part of... But discipleship has something about not beliefs about God, religion, church. That's all essential to it. But for me, it was to talk about expressions of how we're to live out our lives. And I found that to develop discipleship, the answer isn't to talk about prayer. And it wasn't to talk about the gifts of the Spirit. And it was all excellent. But those are not our problems, because even those things don't have a lot of meaning for a lot of moderns. And so I came to the conclusion that if you study the life of Jesus... And what he was involved in, expressing this relationship that he felt with his Father in the life of the world around him. And I believe in our day, it means making a commitment, and these are the topics that I'm going to be talking about in the coming weeks, making a commitment to the poor and to live in solidarity with the poor. I'm going to talk about them in the next session. What does that mean for us? Then I think it makes a commitment to be a peacemaker. And then a commitment to live non-violently. You see, I think we're so caught up in not being peacemakers. Well, we talk about peace, but not the makers of peace. And we're so caught up in a violent society. And we reflect that, really, in the way we act, that it just negates any sense of getting to being open to the power of God in our lives. And then I'm going to suggest that it's seeking justice for all people, not just for ourselves. And then in our day, and there's any number of things, I'm suggesting it's being ecologically responsible. That is, caring for the created order. And to say you have a faith in God, Creator, without caring for the creation is such a contradiction that nothing can come alive in the depth of your spirituality. And then finally, the last session will be living out of grace, or living in grace, in community. And man, we don't know much about community. By the way, I came to this insight from being in Africa. Africans really understand what community is. Americans understand what individualism is. And if we could ever get them together, we'd really have something. They need our witnesses, you know, about the place of the individual and what all that means in social order and all. But what could we learn from them, what it means to be a community? It was interesting. If you had asked an African student to come to the university, hi, I'm Jerry, who are you? They'd tell me, and they'd say, well, I'm a Makumi. I'm a Kandi. I'm Ngogo. They'd tell me the tribe that they were part of. That's who they were. They were a member of a community. Oh, incidentally, my name is, and then they'd tell me their personal name. But that was secondary. Have you ever had that? You ever ask an American who they are? You have to talk to them, you know, to find out what is the community of which they're a part. You got to search for that. Well, I'm suggesting discipleship has to do with following Jesus seriously and radically. That is going to the root of what did he teach and what did he... Not what is the church telling us. Not what is what our culture is. Not even what our own... what we think. Because we've so crested over the teaching and the life of Jesus that I don't know if many people are in touch with the authentic Jesus or whether they're in touch with some idol that we call Jesus. Would anybody like to respond to something at this point? I'm ready to go on to something else.
Yeah.
Go ahead. My idea of discipleship, Jesus said that any man would be my disciple. I don't know the exact words, but it's something about denying himself.
Denying himself.
And taking up his cross and following daily. And I'm just, you know, you don't see many people flocking to the cross and taking up his cross, whatever that means. And I'm just wondering, are you saying that taking up this cross are the social concerns that you're just listed now?
Well, what does taking up your cross mean for you? I guess I'd ask, because for me, when he says, come, follow me, take up your cross, follow me, deny yourself, follow me, I'm saying I think that's what it means. These things that I've enumerated, it means many other things, but for most of us, I'm saying this has not been at the center of what we've seen discipleship being. And so we've missed the thrust, because I believe these are all the things that Jesus was involved with.
Well, the cross involves death, and I think the self instead of... But we're so self-centered, and that has to sort of die, and then God's love flows out through us for that community that you were talking about, villages or neighborhoods or...
What does it mean for you to die?
That's tough. That's why I think in today's church there's very little distinction. There are few that
let me give you an example. I'm saying to deny yourself, take up your cross, all it means some of these things that I'm suggesting. For instance, where I live, most of us are pretty affluent. I mean, we're living. And my guess is most of you are fairly well off. Now, usually people say, you mean if you're going to identify with the poor? You're going to be committed to the poor. What are you asking us to do? To sell everything we have and give away to the poor? Well, if that's it, most of us said that's not realistic. It's not practical. And you're probably right. I don't think that... What does it mean then? Because Jesus was surely committed to the poor. What does it mean for us? And I'm going to suggest some of the things that it means. But, for instance, when you go vote, everybody I know votes for what's in their self-interest. That's not dying to self. And if you live in solidarity with the poor, if I'm going to cast a vote, how do I cast that on behalf of those who are voiceless or powerless? What do I have to vote for? What, in order that those who are outside the present systems, how do they, what is needed? That's one of the things that I would say. Dying to self is to say, I'm going to vote not just in my own self-interest. Back in California, what, about 12 years ago, there was a proposition that froze house taxes. I voted against it. Not that it was great for me. Do you know today, I pay a little over $600 in taxes a year on my house. My neighbor, who has almost exactly the same house, pays about $2,800. But he bought his house 3 years ago. And you pay on the basis of that, and everything was frozen back there. My interest was to support that measure. I'm against it. It's not fair. It's unfair. But that's an example.
You kind of put behaviors, a list of behaviors off limits. And yet these things you're suggesting, peacemaking, ecological responsibility, justice for others, well, so all those sorts of things are behaviors.
Yeah. Okay, well, what I was saying, though, in institutionalization that many of us are part of, that's not the behaviors that are talked about.
I see. And we have to select from what Jesus means to us, and then we say, now that would be reflected in these behaviors by me.
Yes. What is the behavior pattern that's called for as a follower of Jesus? Surely, that must be. And that's not going to be easy.
You stated that the doctrines and teachings of the church and your precepts and so on are not as important as the actual teachings of Jesus as contained in the Gospels. Is that correct? I mean, that's what I got out of it, just what you said. More important than teachings. However, everybody interprets the teachings of Jesus for himself, and sometimes the ideas are diametrically opposed. So it's pretty hard for us to know what the actual teaching of Jesus was, because last night in the sermon, I disagreed with one of the statements of the preacher. I don't know if you want me to expatiate, I will, but I didn't think that the preacher had the right interpretation as to the meaning of Jesus' reply to the woman at the well. Now, that's one example. How do we know? But everybody interprets to himself.
You like the goggle workers, huh?
It was the woman at the well in which the preacher said that Jesus said it's not right to give the bread to the dogs, and she was a dog because she was a foreigner, and she was an alien, and she wasn't a Jew. And she said, yes, but the foreigners eat the bread, the crumbs left the dog on the table. And she was teaching Jesus something. And he learned from that experience. And I don't interpret that way.
Okay.
In other words, he wasn't perfect in his perception and his intuition. I thought he was being sarcastic or being funny. I mean, it's because this was the way.
My guess is he really thought Jesus did learn from that experience.
You really think he learned?
I think so, but I'm not going to get into that one.
Yeah.
But
you could also interpret, couldn't you, that he was being a little ironic? I mean, that he was just funning her in a way. Well, gee, you can't. You're just like a dog. There was a little repartee in the back of the way.
There's. Yes, and by the way, I don't care where you stake discipleship on, there's not going to be full agreement on exactly what that means. So, you know, whether it's churches don't all agree on what beliefs are either, and in behavior.
No, I agree with 100% on McDonald's.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think the church's beliefs have been a very necessary guide to keeping alive the message of Jesus as part of it and helping us interpret it in each age and all. Absolutely. But we recognize that as the church has made teachings over the years, that we've had room for some revisions in them. One of the things I like, if we're going to talk about what did Jesus say and do, we do have a source to look for that, and that's in Scripture. And I believe if we do that, that's why I would urge you to go to the Bible study, because, for instance, today, I learned that when he talked about the Jews, we weren't talking about Jewish people. We were talking about the Judeans. And that's a system of temple authorities and institutionalized bureaucracy that was quite in opposition to what Jesus stood for. Jesus wasn't, he wasn't for any anti-Semitism.
Well, I shouldn't think he would be.
No, what he was opposing was, what?
I shouldn't think he would be because he was a Jew himself.
Right.
And all the disciples
quite honestly, I hadn't understood that. And so I think when we go back and uncover the accumulations that tend to start surrounding Jesus, where we make Jesus pretty much into a 20th century American or 18th century Dane. Being a Dane, I appreciated those things. How do we get past that? What did he say? What did he call us to? And my suggestion, and what I'm suggesting in here, are these things. Let me go on to something. I am Scott Peck. You know, he's the... what do you write?
Road Less Traveled.
The Road Less Traveled was
people
maybe the
lie.
First...
People
of the Lie. And then
different
the different drum was... In that, he talked about patterns of transformation as people grow into what he called spiritual maturity. And I found something very useful, which I'm going to just talk about briefly here, as to why people don't grow into more authentic discipleship. He talks about, in spiritual maturity, there's sort of four levels. And this is a psychiatrist, a giant of a person respected in almost all realms, a deeply devout Christian person, who's done some careful study and research. He talks about, at the level one, is sort of undeveloped spirituality. And he says about 20% of adult people that are part of religious establishments are level one, undeveloped spirituality. And of course, he would say childhood or children, in a sense, move from, from nothing, whatever it is, but by the normal growth, they grow into some level of maturity. Level one people are incapable of giving love. Everybody is manipulated for their own benefit, not for any meaningful relationship, and so on. Most people, though, most persons, sense the need of something, and he talks about what he calls level two spirituality. At this level, people have found some rich, rewarding, meaningful religious experiences. Whether it's the kind of continual developmental growth that many churches advocate, or whether it's a more dramatic experiential thing that comes at suddenly in a life, but that at some point they find a meaningful experience of faith, acceptance by God, and love, and forgiveness, and all those things, and that then they sort of fixate at that point. And they develop a set of beliefs that are consistent with that, and these behavior patterns, and they usually have a form of worship and a concept of what the church ought to be, and so on. And that's where they get stymied. That's where they get hooked in. Now, that's moving from one to two. But he finds such people. He doesn't recognize this as what he calls spiritual maturity. They're very rigid. They're judgmental. They're threatened by any suggestion that maybe the belief system or the worship patterns or the way they're doing things are sufficient or good or the best. They get fixated at that point. By the way, he says, I forget the exact percentage, but it's the largest percentage of people in churches are level two people. And so if you suggest some people shared with me, they had to have all that dancing at the evening vespers that they have on Sunday night. Well, they've got a set of patterns that are comfortable for them, and you know, if people are going to stand around dancing and pounding drums, well, that's something irreverent. That threatens them. Change threatens them. Or do you mean to say women ought to be pastors? Hey, that's not where their spiritual maturity got hooked in at, and they get fixated at them. And so that's threatening to their whole way of understanding their religious experience. Or do you mean to say that gay people should be accepted in the life of the church? Wow. We were always taught that they were sinners. And sure, they'd repent and change, but you mean to say maybe we didn't always understand the scriptures fully? Maybe it was addressing even a broader understanding than you suggest? Or you want to introduce a different kind of liturgy on Sunday morning? Or you want to, you know, by the way, I understand Baptists don't have liturgy. But I've seen some Baptists that have about as rigid a setup as Lutherans who have liturgies or Catholics or something. In other words, they found a comfort zone as an expression of their religious life, and boom, they get stuck there, they get hooked. Now, he said, by the way, without them, the churches would really be in trouble. Because they make the majority of people in churches. And they believe there's a right way to do things. And when the church needs money, hey, they respond. They make pledges. They give. They volunteer to be ushers. They, you know, they do all the things. We're set up to live off that. But this is not yet spiritual maturity.
I was going to say the churches are in trouble. I mean, if by all appearances, sure, there's a whole structure there that where people are giving money and supporting administrative structures that continue to perpetuate some of these traditions that we hold near and dear, which I would be the first to say I would hate to see that some of those go. But if there was a recent article in Newsweek that it was pretty clear by the statistics that they gave that the mainline churches are dying. And
there's a slow process, right. Yes, but I basically agree. Some of those that are thriving may be given some good stuff, and some of them may be given some fraudy stuff too. But
so I guess my point is that you need to get out there and do something rather than maintain these structures that are...
Okay. Exactly, and I think the answer is authentic discipleship. Yeah. He says, for instance, children are raised in these kind of churches, in these kind of families. And they internalize the teachings the church has given them. Lutherans, we send our kids through a confirmation process, and they sit there and they accept them, and you know they're okay. They argue a little bit, but they basically buy them. That's the way it is. But then, as you get a little bit older, typically they start questioning. Wait a minute, are we ready to accept this formalized set of things we've been given? The idea, for instance, that, well, level two people think of God, God's out there. And God is loving, but watch out, because if you don't conform, he will really get you. You'll pay the price. That's a level two understanding. And many people start questioning and then rebelling. And he says people that do this, they may be reverting into level one immaturity, but very likely they're moving into what he would call level three spiritual maturity. They're questioning the dead formality that you say is stifling and killing. I believe it is. And these are potential signs of health and growth. If they lead on to what he calls level four
maturity. By the way, those who are in this questioning rebellious stage often they often hold to some of those beliefs, even when they're decrying them. In fact, they say, well, let's wait around, they'll be back in the church. And a good part of them do come back into the church with those same set of beliefs. And they kind of buy into what they challenged and questioned earlier. Many of these people have a deep social consciousness. Some of these sort of rebels are committed to many of the things that I talked about, those evidences of true discipleship. But they think the church has nothing to do with those things. Commitment to the poor, commitment to nonviolence, peacemaking, so on. They will pretty well write off the church. And I think there's a lot of people that have done that. And they have no confidence in institutions, especially the institution of the church. But truthfully, almost all other institutions, government, universities, educational process, everything else. And they become self-governing. They're not going to depend on some outside authority system. They're going to set their own rules.
Third or fourth? Third level or fourth level?
Third level. And if, hopefully, people at this level will move on to what he calls spiritual maturity, or they may revert to level one, undeveloped spirituality. But at that level, he calls it a mature, communal, mystical stage of spiritual development. By that he means communal, that is, a willingness to accept differences and diversity in the community of faith. Other people do not have to agree. Other people don't have to conform to their set of expectations, and that's okay. The rigidity of level two people has moved into a more accepting of a great deal of diversity. They're accepted sort of without condition. Simply, if they're serious in their search, great. They also accept people, if they're spiritually mature, who are at level two. Level three people, I can't accept, you know, all that stagnant formality and deadness in the church. But a mature person doesn't demand perfection of everybody else. They're ready to accept. They'll even listen to a pastor's sermons. They know they're not the last word. The pastor, sometimes they'll disagree with him, but possibly he'll enlighten them. He'll really say a word of God to them. Spiritually mature people can do that. It's mystical, he says. That is, they sense there's a certain unity and connectedness between everything. People of different races, people of different religions, people of different social and economic classes, in fact, share a great deal in commonness, even though there's some differences. We humans are even related to the cosmos, to the earth, to the animals, yeah, we're creatures along with them, but somehow our fate, our lives are intertwined with theirs. Mature people, the whole ecological matter, is right there because they sense this mystical unity of things. Mature people accept mystery. Level two people cannot accept mystery. They have to have the answer. They have to know the truth. There has to be it's correct, it's right. Level two people enter religion to escape mystery. Level four people enter religion to discover mystery. Phrase he uses.
Well, I was just wondering, as you're talking about this, if maybe we could say that level four people have had an authentic experience of the love of God, and therefore they've been free from having to build all the defenses that often are what keep us from doing these things and from accepting others. I mean, maybe level two people had some kind of experience that touched on it, but maybe not the full thing. Because as you describe them, you know, that you're describing how sometimes I am when I feel real threatened.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, there is a degree of level two in all of us, he would say. And even in level two people, here and there, now and then, they sense a level four spiritual maturity.
And sometimes I'm at level four when I really feel an authentic experience of the love of God. That's very freeing. So that's what I'm wondering if that is what
Absolutely. How do we grant this experience of the love of God? How do we help people encounter that and how do we help people not to believe in grace? Every Lutheran I know believes in grace. You know, we're saved by grace, justified through faith. But I don't know if they sense they're undergirded by grace. They can live gracefully. You know, they can dare to live and, you know, they're bold enough to sin bravely, as Luther said. He understood that understanding, that experience. And with it came that spiritual maturity. How do we get there? Well, I'm going to be suggesting in the coming sessions that the reason is that we've so institutionalized and privatized our religion that we haven't been in touch with the real Jesus who's revealed in Scripture and who the Church proclaims. And that Jesus, for instance, he lived nonviolently. And if you're going to talk about love, it's a nonviolent love. And I hear people say, but that's just not realistic. And anybody with any sense knows that the kind of violence of our age with, you know, nuclear weapons and atomic weapons and all that stuff, man, the answers that we've come up with war and spending $300 billion a year on armaments, that's not realistic. The foolish Russians spent themselves into disintegration because they had the wrong emphasis. But we outmatched them. And frankly, a lot of our difficulties, our troubles are centered right there. The nation, I don't know how you feel about politics, but the present administration has a peacetime budget. On military matters, what is it? Is it 3% less than the Bush budget?
Trillions of dollars.
What?
It's many billions of dollars.
it's really peanuts less. And here we have this breakthrough, this opportunity. We haven't taken advantage of it. We're a violent people in a violent society. And I don't believe you're going to begin to appreciate. I don't think you have an experience of the grace of Jesus and its immenseness and really let it saturate you when we're caught up in the violence of our age. And I think radical discipleship, once we sense that's not the way of Jesus, suddenly what he's talking about, God, the one you can call Father, the one who is not in a punishment, retribution relationship, but rather is in a redeeming, graceful relation. I think we can begin to understand that. But when you're caught up in not the ways of Jesus, but in the ways of darkness, the ways of death, the ways of the world, and to a degree, it's hard not to be caught up in that today.
You consider Jesus driving the money changers off the temple precincts with whips in a peace-loving act. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Well, the pastor last night would have said, well, but Jesus had to learn. I don't know. That's the one that's always brought up. But of course, he also said to Peter, hey, put away that sword. You know, if you try to live by the sword, you're going to die by it. And on and on and on. And, yeah.
I wonder if that wasn't maybe an act of a human response. He was angry because they were doing it. And it's the only time mentioned that he did something like that. And I'm wondering if, that wasn't usual. That wasn't his usual nature.
Jesus got angry.
Oh, yeah.
You read the New Testament in Greek, and he called those Pharisees some names you and I wouldn't call each other.
Sticks and stones can break my bones, but what is it? Words can never harm me?
Blades, sucklers.
Good. We're going to be talking about this down the way. It's
a more colorful expression. Okay.
But where do you get what I'm getting after? What I'm saying, people would come to me and say, I know something's wrong in my life. I want something richer in my faith. I know it's not the power that it ought to be in my life. You ever heard people ever say that to you? Some of you are pastors, or you, or people have come to you and said that kind of thing. And so what's the answer? Well, I discovered that, I'm going to teach you about the Trinity. Somehow that didn't help them with that experience of grace and gracefulness and love. Or, if you would just pray more, or attend church more regularly, or many of the things that we've tended to do, which I think are more private expressions of faith. Good, important. But what I'm suggesting is because we have not taken seriously that discipleship is following Jesus, and that we've so covered over who Jesus is and what he said that we've missed what the teacher is teaching us by his own life example and by his teaching. I am suggesting that these things I've listed are legitimate expressions in our day and age of what it means to take that seriously. And when I go and visit my brother-in-law, and he tells me, listen, I know the National Rifle Association isn't perfect, but I belong to it, and I think everybody ought to have the right to carry pistols because that's the only way we can protect ourselves. I want to say to him, this is totally foreign to the way of Jesus. It just has nothing to do with the way of Jesus. That's not where safety, security, or anything else is found. And I have no way of helping him to develop that presence of God, that sense of the love of God, the grace of God, without tackling at the points where I think he's blind, or there's a block between him and following Jesus.
As I think about it, it seems to me that the story of Jesus driving the money changers from the temple is not out of keeping. It's consistent with what you're talking about. I mean, aren't the people whom Jesus was driving from the temple, weren't these people kind of extorting the common people as they came? They came with the sheep, and they'd say, well, that sheep isn't good enough, and they'd turn around and, they might sell the same sheep to another person that came later in the day. I mean, they were clearly doing some things that were out of keeping with, an honest way of going about providing that service. It seems to me that there are some things in our lives about which we ought to be angry, and if we aren't, maybe there's something wrong with us. And this whole business of taking advantage of the poor and, coercing them into believing that their gift is insufficient, it might be one of those. I don't know, just an observation.
I think the anger, is, there ought to be, in a sense, anger about any kind of injustice. But the question then of taking up the whips and driving them out doesn't seem quite consistent with the message of nonviolence.
Well, yes, they were.
But sometimes, of course, I don't think it's consistent to try to save a nation by obliterating it with bombs and destroying it. That's not consistent.
I was just going to make one observation in regards to, yes, they were all on the thieves and took advantage of the poor, but isn't that the same thing as saying as people justifying themselves for bombing the abortion clinics? I mean, they say, well, they're saving lives by doing that. So, you know, it's the same thing. It's a question.
There's no question that following Jesus is not a simple thing, and it's a constant, what does it mean? And I'm sure in his humanity he struggled with that question. Let me tell you a key. It never bothered me that 100% of the congregation that I dealt with wasn't what I would call spiritually mature Christians. Hey, forget it. That's not going to happen. There's no way that most people are going to be able to follow Jesus to that extent. If they're striving, if they're searching, if they desire, you celebrate with them, you dance with them, you encourage them. Some of them will break through that experience. Some of them will grow to that. In a congregation, I think if you have 10% of the people. But of course, that's dangerous too, because who are the 10%? You know, and a good question, am I part of it? You know, maybe I am, maybe I'm not. I don't think we need to worry. I think what we need to worry about is, what did Jesus say? What did he do? What was his life pattern? And he's the teacher, he's the master, he's the guru, he's the Lord, he's the Savior, whatever. And we're to follow that. And that's all discipleship is. And so I think it's unfortunate that we don't live in a totally recognized un-Christian society. You know, then if there were a few people that were Christians, we could deal with that. But when, you know, we'd like to make everybody Christian, but let's face it, we're all to be children of God. We are children of God. We're accepted. We're loved by God. But we're beckoned into discipleship, a higher, better, more complete way. Listen, the time is up. I've got Vespers tonight, and I got to start thinking about what that's going to be. Can I close there?
Sure.
I'm going to be teaching this thing Wednesday at 3:30. Not tomorrow. They didn't schedule me tomorrow. And I hope some of you will be around. And just ask yourself the question. Am I a member of a church, or am I a disciple of Jesus as a member of the church? And if you're not a member of the church, you gotta be. Spiritually mature people are ready to accept all the foolish things that go on in churches. You know, sure, it's okay, because we're there together, searching for it. I gotta go.
And eventually the world will come to that. And, you know, we're in a phase now that people start to realize that enough people, the main problem is that there's just not enough faith. There's not enough, and that God's going to keep working on us.
Well, I think one of the main problems in Bosnia is that we don't accept other people's faith.
Yeah,
we're not tolerant. Mm-hmm. I've got my God, and you believe the way I do are with you. And I think that has to stop.
Well, there's some deep-seated ethnic relationships there too. It's just not a religious war. I mean, you know, that's sort of like saying that in Ireland it was Catholics and Protestants, and that was the core of the battle, and it really wasn't.
But it's intolerance of each other.
Well, yeah, but it's not necessarily a religious intolerance.
But then intolerance is basically a religious issue.
Would you
be willing to? Yeah. That's another thing. Would you be willing to separate the words religion and faith?
Well,
Do they have different definitions?
Well, yes, they do to me. You got, I don't know if I can do it, articulate it right now. But I think that if we are to love each other, then we love each other no matter what they believe.
Well, that's the difficulty. Because it's not just that, it's just not the folks out there that we love. What about those those folks in this pure doctrine movement? They're recipients of love too, I suspect, aren't they?
Sure.
And so sometimes that the love gets focused, it's sort of like in Central America. How do you help people being oppressed love the oppressor?
Well, that was one of the.
But I mean, because that's a serious concern. I mean, if as Christian people, love, it isn't just love for people who you feel are maybe oppressed, but it's love, it's an extension of God's love, show love to those who are also oppressing. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think we come up short on. It's a lot easier to love the ones that are oppressed than it is to love the oppressor.
Right, but
that's the challenge of our. I think that's one of the big challenges of faith.
I just come from a sanctuary church.
But
what is loving the oppressor? What is the act of love towards the oppressor? Is it confronting with the judgment of what? I mean, if you talk about loving, I think that's the hard question. What is really loving the oppressor? It's not allowing them to continue to oppress. It's confronting them to.
That could be one way. But the other thing is that if you want to talk about it in terms of how you were talking, say, about Somalia, going in and giving a sense of, the relationship that you have with Christ to that person in trying to develop a sense of community, that's another way of doing it. It's a really tough, I agree, it's a tough issue. But I just think it's easier to love someone who's oppressed than it is to love someone who's doing the oppression. If someone oppresses me, I certainly have a much better. I'm not all that keen on loving somebody who oppresses me.
We're getting away from the text quite a bit here, but that's okay. I like to hear. I have to preach on Sunday, so I need to know what people are thinking. Segundo Galilea, who is a liberation theologian, has a phrase to deal with. That's a lot of people in Latin America have thought of that very issue that you're raising, is how do you love the oppressor? And the way he says it in just one really short phrase, he says, salvation of the sinner and liberation of the poor. Now that's not to say that the poor are not sinful. The poor are sinful in different ways. What he's talking about is one major relationship that's definitive in our world, is that there are a few people that have oppressed millions of people, and most of us have to agree that we're
oppressed.
Some of us are oppressed and oppressors. Most of us are in that ambiguous situation. So you have to ask yourself, which relationship am I talking about? If you're talking about economic relationships, almost all of us here are oppressors. Whenever we drink a cup of coffee, we oppress somebody, because people in Guatemala work for 3 hours a day, picking by hand. They don't have any medical care. And they pick the coffee so that we can drink it. What he says, salvation of sinners and liberation of the poor, he's talking about one particular kind of sin, which is...